Chapter 5. Laura. The night before. Thursday, 7:30 p.m. Branston, Connecticut. Jonathan, John, Johnny, Jack. As I drive downtown, I wonder what people call him. There's traffic and I'm running late. Construction, one-lane road. Shit. It's good to be late. Keep him waiting. I tell this to myself. I can be one of those women who pull this off, hide the eagerness, hide the desire. I think about texting him, but he said he doesn't like to text. I don't want to call because that's a little extreme. And, of course, my phone is on low battery because I forgot the charger from my room. God forbid Rosie should leave one in the car. He'll wait 10 minutes. Won't he? The minivan smells like goldfish and apple juice. Rosie cleans it every week, but it makes no difference. I don't think she smells it anymore. She's so used to it. Like this stale coffee that pervades the kitchen until Joe comes home from work and empties the pot. The kitchen is Rosie's domain until then, and I usually find her there staring at nothing while Mason watches cartoons. She pours me the stale coffee to chase away the bourbon hangovers from late nights with Joe and Gabe, and recites mantras from her days as a feminist, with the same breath that she gives me advice on how to be attractive. You don't need a man, Laura. Not for anything. At the risk of stating the obvious, it's easy to say you don't need something when you're holding it in your hands. She might as well tell me she doesn't need her coffee as she inhales her second cup. Still, I consider her advice now, as I feel the panic that he might leave because I'm 10 minutes late. I don't need a man. The only trouble is that after years of wondering why it was so hard for me to find one, I finally had done just that, found a man who loved me. He didn't stay long, but while he was here, he unlocked the door to a well of needs, and there were so many of them. The need to be held and touched, the need to laugh and cry and search another's soul, the need to be seen, to be known. Not the fierce and fearless warrior who conquered the world, but the little girl tugging on a sleeve or the hem of a coat, looking up. Always, always looking up with the foolish hope that someone would look back and be happy to see me there. I am pathetic with my silly daydreams. Jonathan Fields. Do they call you Nathan or Nate? I wonder if he's handsome in real life. I wonder if his hair is as dark and full as his pictures, his eyes as blue. His body as fit as it looks hidden beneath his shirt. I wonder if I will see that thing in his eyes that I love. Mischief. Just a little. Not the kind old me likes. Just enough to keep her quiet. But whatever I see when my eyes first fall upon Jonathan Fields, I will not ignore it. I will not pretend he is the right man if there is clear evidence that he is the wrong man. And I will not invent evidence to prove he's the wrong man if he's the right man. I am handicapped by a lack of instinct. Tonight will not be easy. Jonathan Fields. I'm almost there. Past the construction on Main Street, I make a left on Hyde, another on Richmond. I find a spot at a meter and pull in. We're meeting at an Irish pub that is just on the block behind me. On the left, it's nestled in between an upscale diner and an Italian place. They have seating outside in the summer. When we were kids, we used to get in with our fake IDs. I think it's harder these days, but maybe they've learned how to make better IDs. Ours were more pathetic than my daydreams. I have so many memories from growing up in this town. They've been crawling out from every corner since the day I returned. Jonathan Fields suggested this place. He said it was near his apartment, so he went there a lot and the bartenders would give him free whiskey. Not that he couldn't afford whiskey. He made sure to throw that in. And I have not done anything with any of this information. I've left my scaffolding at home. There will be no interventions tonight, no reconstructions, no blind eyes. I had an excellent therapist, even if I was a terrible patient. I opened the vanity mirror and checked my face. Mascara hasn't smudged, cheeks are rosy. I apply some more cherry red lipstick because I've been biting my lip. I rub some of it off my teeth with my finger. That's really not a good look. Lipstick on your teeth? Seriously, that could have been a fatal, unforced error. Damn it, have I become my mother? I close the mirror and stare out the windshield, onto the street. After Dick left us, our mother couldn't sleep or eat unless she had a boyfriend, and she would go to the bottom of the barrel to find one. After Dick left us, she went out almost every night, and I remember hating her for it. How do I look, girls? We don't give a shit, Mom. We have homework and tests and our periods and zits and the other tortures of puberty to deal with. Alone, thank you very much. I don't want to be someone I hate. But maybe that's what's required. I feel that thing in my stomach. It's not quite anxiety, not quite nervousness. It is distinct, a feeling specific to this set of circumstances, a first date after a bad breakup. It's hope, but it's so fragile. Hope on its deathbed, people gathered around it saying prayers, a priest standing over it reading last rites. Part of me has already grieved it. Part of me can't until it's totally dead, maybe even until it's been buried 6 feet under. I need a drink, ASAP. Hand on the handle, door open. Grab purse, phone, keys, close the door, lock the car. It's 7:38. I walk like I could give a shit about anything, across the street, down the block. My heart is beating faster and it's pissing me off. I breathe slower, but it makes it worse. I can feel my cheeks getting redder than they already were. A small group of people stands outside, smoking and laughing. They've clearly enjoyed happy hour drink prices. I walk around them and find the door, pull the handle, step inside. The bar is dark, dimly lit, wood paneling. There are tables in the back and loud music playing in the front, which is packed with people of all ages, except middle. Middle-aged people are home with their kids. It's Thursday night, after all. I scan the crowd. Two naughty girls to my right, drunk and slutty, talking to three young executives, douchebags. I wonder how that math is going to work out. To my left are five colleagues from a medical office. They're still wearing their cotton candy shirts and badges. Dead center is the bar, lined with an assortment of men and women. No one is alone. Shit. Did he leave? Did he blow me off? No, no, no. The thought rips through me, and I realize in an instant how vulnerable I am tonight. It doesn't sit well, being vulnerable. It makes me feel like a wild animal trapped in a corner. Nothing left to do but fight its way out. It brings back memories of things I don't want to remember. So many mistakes, so many regrets. They come in flashes, sweeping in like sarin gas, devastating every nerve in my body, paralyzing me with self-hatred. I realize now that I have started to believe in Jonathan Fields when he is nothing more than a name and a voice and a story on a page. I have let it all swirl around in my head and become a real person, like a kid with an imaginary friend. Insanity, desperation. I've done it again. I haven't followed the instructions. This does not bode well. I feel a hand on my shoulder and I turn.
Laura, he says.
There he is. Jonathan Fields, saving me from myself. Saving himself from me, though he doesn't know it. He's beautiful. I almost gasp. That's how beautiful he is. And I haven't even had a drink. Blue eyes, dark hair, just like his pictures. Only his face has structure that the pictures didn't capture, the way his cheekbones frame his perfect nose, the way his smile pulls higher on one side, more endearing than smug. And his body, that slender, fit body, it moves with masculine grace. All of this rushes in and sweeps me away. Yeah. Jonathan? I'm so perfectly collected right now. I don't know how, because the emotional 180 has nearly killed me.
I want to crawl under the covers in Rosie's attic and disappear from the world. His eyes scan me up and down. It's a little odd, to be honest, but if he's feeling any bit of what I'm feeling, nothing would be odd. I'm blinded by a surge of adrenaline. I have no sense of myself. Then he speaks.
Sorry, it's just, well, you're really beautiful.
I let his words enter my brain for processing. I get my shit together, clear the sarin from my bloodstream. The adrenaline clears as well, and the words get through. They sound sincere. Check. And they explain his roving eyes. Check. All good. I smile. I have to force myself. Voices echo in the distance. My sisters. The ghosts of my past. They tell me I shouldn't be here. Go home. Get under the covers. He looks around. His eyes pause on the back room with the tables. He loses his smile, but only for a second.
Listen, he says. This place is kind of crowded. I'd really like to go somewhere quiet, where we can talk and get to know each other.
He's not wrong. It's loud and smells like stale beer. People are laughing too hard because they're drunk at 7:45 on a Thursday. And he wants to talk. That's a good sign. I walk back from the ledge of an emotional inferno. Sure, I say. I smile again. He touches my arm and leads me in front of him toward the door. As we're walking out, past the sluts and douchebags and cotton candy uniforms, I think I hear someone call his name. I try to look back where the tables are, where the voice came from, but he moves past me and waves me on to follow. When he gets to the door, he opens it and ushers me outside, then to the corner of Richmond and Maple. He doesn't stop walking until we're in the parking lot of a CVS. I follow, not asking where we're going. I don't know why. Well, that's not really true. He turns to face me, a little winded. He looks over my shoulder, then back at me with a smile.
Sorry about that. I just couldn't hear myself thinking there. It's been one of those days.
I know exactly what to say. It's fine. I've had some of those myself. What do you want to do? I'm so understanding. It's all about you, Jonathan Fields. He points to a building just down the block.
That's where I live. I'm parked in the garage. Want to take my car and go down to the water? There's a ton of places down there.
Sure, I say with enthusiasm. Anything you want, Jonathan Fields. We start to walk.
I hope you don't take this the wrong way, but I was so relieved when I saw you.
I get it now. He hid in the back somewhere until he could scope me out. So, what would you have done if I was old, fat, and ugly? My tone is slick, and I hate myself again. I hear Rosie.
It's not that hard. Just be nice, for God's sake.
Nice. Be nice, not slick, not irreverent. But then he laughs. He finds my irreverence amusing. I fight to keep from making assumptions, drawing conclusions. Maybe he's just nervous. People laugh when they're nervous. It doesn't mean he sees old me, real me, and likes her. It doesn't mean anything. We just met. Do not invent him. And I'm the one who should be nervous. I'm walking now into an underground parking garage, alone with this man, this stranger, no one else in sight. He pulls out his keys and clicks the button. A Toyota sedan lights up. It's not the car I was expecting from a 40-year-old banker with no kids to feed. It's not the black BMW he told me about. It's not that I care about money. I've fallen for all kinds of men, teachers, students, a handyman. It's just that it's not adding up. But what do I know about divorce and alimony and the cost of keeping a house and an apartment? Nothing. Well, maybe a little. It's not rocket science. Maybe his BMW's in the shop. I'm so very good at inventing stories. But anyway, it's too late. He opens my door and I get inside. The door closes and my stomach tightens. This was supposed to be simple. I was supposed to be new me tonight, just a girl who wore a dress and went on a date. My head is throbbing. I'm so tired from the emotional roller coaster of the past 15 minutes. Facts are spinning around and around. The car, his story. And that woman's voice from the back of the bar, calling after him as we made a hasty departure. Please let me be wrong, Jonathan Fields. Please be the man you said you were. Please, please, please. Because I don't know what I'll do if you're not.
Chapter 6. Rosie, present day, Friday, 5:30 a.m., Branston, Connecticut. Rosie stood before the empty bed. She drew both hands to her mouth, open palms pressed to her lips to silence the fear. She started to turn, run back downstairs to tell Joe that Laura really hadn't come home last night. But then she stopped. He would just repeat his theory about how she got carried away, about Laura being Laura. So she began the search for her sister, alone. It felt strange to be among Laura's things, and she paused to consider her actions. It was a violation. There was no way around it. She knew her sister at her core, but the outer layers that had been built around it these past 10 years, she knew nothing of those. Only benign facts. What she studied in college. The basic tasks of her job as an analyst. A vague description of her office and colleagues. Bitchy Betty. Hot Henry. She had a best friend there, a woman named Jill. The two of them had made up nicknames for everyone else. It was funny, but impersonal. Rosie didn't even know if she'd been happy there. When Rosie called her, and even when she'd gone in with Mason to see her at her apartment, they spoke of sandwich shops and political scandals and Mason not sleeping in his bed and the Stepford Wives at the Mommy and Me classes. Never about the layers. Not Laura's. And not her own. Rosie hadn't even met her roommate, who never seemed to be there on the weekends. She had a boyfriend in New Jersey who had his own place. Having Laura here, in her house, felt more like hosting a family friend who'd come for a visit than a family member. So it also felt strange to be in her room, looking through her private things. And yet, at the same time, she was family. And Rosie was worried the way only family can worry because of the history they shared and the things she knew, and how those things now made her feel. The mother bear protecting her cub. Something is wrong. It was a familiar feeling, one she'd had since she wore braids and plaid kilts and would find Laura in her room, crying under her bed where no one would see her, or up in that tree, fear overcoming the determination that made her start climbing. No one remembers that Rosie had gone up after her more than once, swallowing her own fear to help her sister get back down. But that was the truth. What is the truth now, Laura? Where are you? She shook off the apprehension and let her eyes scan the room the way they never had before, even when she'd come to find her sister here, bringing her food, bringing Mason to jump on her bed. Seeing if she wanted to go for a walk or a drive or sneak out for a drink after Joe got home. She'd been in this room dozens of times, and yet never seen it beyond Laura. It was always just a setting, a backdrop. Now it was transformed in her absence. She looked around carefully. There were 4 coffee mugs, some empty, some with remnants days old. Also 3 dirty dessert plates, 4 water glasses. Rosie gathered them slowly, methodically piling them on the floor just outside in the hallway. Her eyes turned next to the unmade bed, the black eye shades that lay across a pillow, the sheets and blankets tangled from restless sleep. Dreams. Nightmares, maybe. Does the past visit you at night, Laura? Is that why you can't sleep? She shook out the covers and then made the bed, replaced the throw pillows that had fallen to the floor. Laura was everywhere in this room. Her smell, her clothes strewn about the pieces of furniture, a chair, a bedside table, even the floor. They hung in the closet and draped from the shelves where they had been placed without any concern for folding, for order. And Rosie found herself straightening them as she checked the pockets, undoing the chaos in this room as though it might turn back the clock and bring Laura home safe and sound. It was just after 5:30 when she sat at Laura's desk. A laptop was open, its screen black. Papers and books were stacked in piles. A notepad, pens, writings on paper. Rosie looked through them, slowly at first, cautiously, as though Laura might walk through the door and see her. It was ridiculous. Of course she was looking for something, anything that might tell her where her sister had gone. If for no other reason than she had Rosie's car and she had promised to have it back by morning. Page after page, there was nothing but work, notes and data about companies. She'd said she was staying on top of things. Rosie hadn't fully believed her. She started then with desk drawers, finding most of them empty. A stapler, but that was Joe's when this had been his desk. Some more pens, paper clips. Nothing personal. Not even a checkbook. She closed the last one and sat back in the chair, her eyes now on the computer. She placed her finger on the trackpad and swirled it slowly until the screen came to life. It wasn't locked. She sat back then and stared at the screen, now filled with the color from a photograph. Rosie was startled as she saw herself staring back, just 10 perhaps, with Laura, who must have been 8. Beyond them, at the edge of the creek that ran behind their house, were 2 little boys. She knew them instantly. One of them was Joe, strong and tan, his dark hair long past his ears. How strange it was to see him as a boy. To be reminded that they'd been friends since birth, that they'd ever been friends like that, wild and free and young. The other boy was Gabe, of course. He was the opposite of Joe, tall and slender with a buzz cut. Each of them was so different, like they'd been cast in a television show. Still, the 4 of them had been inseparable, and even though other kids came and went, they were the ones who'd stayed together until the end of junior high when Joe's family moved closer to town. Rosie hadn't seen this picture for years since their mother had left for California. Laura must have had it copied and scanned. But when? And why? Laura hated everything about her past here. They'd been collecting frog eggs that day, large masses of gray jelly with tiny black dots. They used to put them in buckets of water and wait for the tadpoles to hatch, which only happened once over the years. They'd been too young to know that the eggs needed to be fertilized after they were laid. It hadn't mattered. The excitement had been in the hunt and the waiting and, of course, the friendship that surrounded the adventure. Rosie wore candy-striped shorts and a pink shirt with frills around the collar. Laura was in her tomboy attire by then, dirty jeans, torn t-shirt. Their skin was tan, their hair streaked blonde from the sun. Rosie was smiling, a big, wide smile right at the camera. Laura's face was not empty exactly, but searching, her eyes not focused on the camera, but instead on the person behind it, holding it. Her eyes were on their father, her image out of focus because she was not the subject of the lens or the man behind it. Rosie was. Not Laura, though her eyes pleaded to have the camera turned her way. To focus on her. Good Lord, how this knowledge struck hard, as though it were the first time she'd found it. She leaned forward and studied her sister. How far back did it go? The angry child, fits of rage, uncontrollable. Rosie tried to remember. It was forever, their whole lives. Laura had bloodied her fists even back when she still wore pink, pounding them into a wall, breaking through the plaster. Rosie closed her eyes to see it clearly. Blood dripping on a snow-white arm, tears streaking a freckled face. She couldn't have been more than 6. Had anyone else bothered to see her? The grown-ups in the neighborhood had their own lives. Couples sipping cocktails on someone's patio. Wives sipping coffee in the kitchens. Men drinking beer, their lawnmowers idling side by side on a Sunday afternoon. A wave of guilt made her close her eyes. Their mother told Mrs. Wallace that day in the kitchen that Laura had been hard to love, the little girl with fists for hands, with rage inside her. But maybe they had created the rage. All of them. She knew this now, having her own child, how easy it was to damage them with nothing more than words, or indifference. None of that mattered now. Time only moved in one direction. Rosie started to click on the icons. 2 hours later, she heard the floorboards creaking. First came the slow, heavy steps of her husband, then the quick shuffles of her son. She heard her name being called, first by Joe, Rosie, then by Mason.
Mama?
Morning was here, though she tried to deny it. Even as the dark sky began to turn gray and then orange, even as the clock ticked relentlessly on the table beside the bed. Minutes, then hours had passed with no headlights coming down the driveway. Rosie? Joe was outside the door, knocking softly.
I'm here,
she answered. The door creaked open. Joe stood in the hallway, holding Mason. As usual, he was bare down to his diaper. Mason hated clothing.
What you doing?
Joe asked. Rosie looked at him with wide, manic eyes. She could feel her expression, and she could see its reflection on Joe's.
She didn't come home.
Joe nodded. He let their squirming child down, and he ran to Laura's bed and climbed on top of the covers. She had a fluffy down comforter, and Mason liked the way it felt against his skin.
Okay, Joe said calmly. You been in here since before? When you woke me up?
Rosie didn't answer. She looked at her son, then back at her husband. Suddenly, she felt as crazy as the person he was seeing.
Hospital? Joe asked.
4 times.
Her phone?
Every 15 minutes. Goes right to voicemail. Why won't she answer?
Because it's dead.
Look, he said, pointing to an outlet near the floor.
She left her charger. Again. She does it all the time.
Rosie nodded.
I tried to find this guy on that website, but there are so many of them, and they use screen names. And I can't get into her account unless I have the password, but I can't change the password without access to her email. I've tried everything. Her birthday, initials, and there's nothing in all this stuff. Just work. Christ, Joe, I even tried Deer Hill Lane.
She would never use that. Not after what happened there.
I know. I'm losing my mind.
Joe walked to the table where Rosie was working. She looked up at him, afraid to let him see her and what was going on in her head.
I don't know what to think, what to believe.
Listen to me. Your sister is lying in a bed, trapped beneath some old dude's hairy arm. She's got a wicked hangover, and she's desperate to sneak out of there without having to fuck him, because that's what he'll want if he wakes up. You'll see.
Joe reached out and stroked her hair, waiting for a smile. But she couldn't comply.
Did you find any evidence suggesting that my theory is wrong?
There is something strange, Rosie said. Look.
Rosie typed the name Jonathan Fields into a search engine.
There's no divorce record, at least not in Connecticut.
Joe sat down on the edge of the bed next to the table and turned the laptop to face him.
So maybe he got divorced in New York or New Jersey or anywhere. Did Laura say where he lived?
I assumed he was local.
Joe shook his head quickly.
No, no. See, that's what I'm saying. He could be from anywhere in driving distance.
Then we'll never find him.
Mason crawled into his father's lap, rolled over, and hung upside down across his legs.
Take a deep breath. It's still early. At least take a shower and have some coffee. You look deranged right now.
Thanks. That was the look I was going for.
Joe tickled his son's belly. Mason laughed.
Come here, baby.
Mason found his mother's arms. She pulled him close and tried to smile. It was unconvincing.
I'll take a shower.
Joe got up, Mason back in his arms.
I'll make coffee and feed this guy. I can go in late today.
7 turned to 8. 8 turned to 9. By 9:30, Rosie was inconsolable and obsessed with Jonathan Fields. She was in the kitchen now, with Laura's laptop open on the table. She stared at the screen as she scrolled through images of men with the same name on Google. But the name was so common, there was no way she would ever find him. Joe stood with Gabe at the center island, holding Mason in one arm and Rosie's bag in the other. Gabe had come the second they'd called him.
"So, what's the plan here?"
Gabe asked.
"I'm gonna drive around, look for the car. Mason can watch shows on the iPad."
"Richmond?"
"Also the garage on Main."
"Yeah, and the harbor. But she only left 15 minutes to get where she was going, so downtown's a better bet." Rosie heard them. She heard every word. She heard the silence that followed and felt their eyes on her back. But she couldn't turn away from the images. Joe started to move. Two steps and he was standing behind her. He kissed the top of her head.
"I'm going now," he said.
Rosie reached her hand back, finding his face. Joe pressed her hand to his cheek, then kissed her palm.
"I'll call if I find something. You do the same."
She couldn't turn around. She didn't want to see the worry that had crept behind his eyes. This guy, whoever he was, supposedly had a job that he would now be at if nothing had gone wrong last night. Gabe answered for both of them.
"You got it."
Rosie heard the door to the garage open and close. Gabe pulled up a chair beside her.
"Hey," he said.
"Hey.
You hanging in there?"
Rosie shook her head. "No."
"We'll find her."
She managed a nod, but Gabe didn't let it go.
"Hey, listen to me now."
Rosie turned to face him.
"There are 100 scenarios between Laura nursing a hangover in this guy's bed and whatever it is you're thinking. Most of them fall within the Laura being Laura category. She's been wound up pretty tight since she got back."
Rosie nodded.
"No police?" he asked.
"No. You know I can't do that unless this is real. Jesus, Laura Lochner, back 10 years later, reported missing with a man she didn't even know."
Gabe sat back and held out his hands. "Okay, I got it. No police until we know for sure."
"You think it's a mistake? Not calling them?"
"That's not my decision."
"No," Rosie thought.
This fell on her shoulders. She'd thought about calling the police since the moment she'd found that empty bed.
But what if she was wrong? What if they were wrong? What if this was just Laura being Laura?
They all knew what would happen. The past would come screaming out of the shadows. It would be big news in this small town.
The computer screen went back to the photograph in the woods, down by the creek. It caught Gabe's eye.
"Oh my God. Look at us."
He smiled then, and in a way that brought back memories. They had each played a role in their shared childhood story.
Joe, their strong, handsome leader.
Rosie, the pretty girl looking on, as Laura, the reckless tomboy, found some kind of trouble. And then there was Gabe, the brains of the operation. That was what she needed now. Someone whose mind could focus through the storm. Someone to think and figure this out. Gabe worked in IT. Sometimes he worked for clients who needed access to things that others didn't want them to find.
"What can we do?"
Rosie asked him, pulling him back from his own memories. He slid the laptop closer and woke up the screen.
"These dating sites, the ones with the complicated profiles and rules, they're actually easier to manipulate, to create a false identity. Men can find women, make their dates, and stay hidden to certain people, a wife or a girlfriend who's come on to find them. Can't do that on the phone apps. Those feed off Facebook. Most people can't be bothered to make a fake Facebook account, and even when they do, they look fake."
"Can we get into Laura's account? See the men she's contacted?" Rosie asked.
"Not without a password or access to her email. You said you've been searching the site?"
Rosie clicked on the icon that held her search.
"I kept it within 20 miles of here. Look, it could be any of these guys. We've got no photo and no screen name, so I can't narrow it down.
Gabe studied the pages, the faces of the men who might be Jonathan Fields. Then he began to type.
I'm going to widen the search to 30 miles. Can you print these pages?
Okay. But why?
Gabe was already on his phone. I have a contact at Verizon. I can get the location of where her phone is, or at least the last place it was live. We'll see what's around there and bring the photos. Maybe we'll get lucky.
That's it? Rosie asked. Can't we hack into her email or get her call record? I know she was in touch with him to make their plan for the date.
The police can, Gabe said.
He looked up from the screen again, his phone pressed to his ear.
With a warrant. Same for this website. They don't like to betray their clients. Doesn't help business.
Rosie watched and listened as Gabe made his call. It sounded like a woman on the other end of the line. He made small talk, let out a quick laugh.
When he asked for the favor, his voice grew more serious.
Please let her be okay.
Rosie's phone rang. She picked it up from the table. Gabe's eyes followed her as she moved across the room. It was Joe.
Hey,
Rosie whispered.
Joe was yelling over the sound of the street noise, but his words came through loud and clear. I found the car. It's on Richmond. I found it.
Thank God. Is she there? Is anything there inside?
Gabe's expression grew curious. Joe sounded breathless.
Just her other purse. There's nothing in it but junk. She got a parking ticket at 7:45 p.m. and another at 10 this morning. They're on the windshield. It's been here all night. What do you want to do?
Rosie didn't answer. She held the phone away from her ear and looked at Gabe, shaking her head. He seemed to understand.
Rosie?
Joe said again.
Gabe may have something.
Rosie's phone went silent just as Gabe got his answer. He stood up and started pacing as he listened.
Are you sure?
He asked the woman on the other line.
Joe was speaking again into Rosie's ear. What did he find?
Hold on,
she said. Then to Gabe.
What did they say?
The phone is offline. Last place it was live was down by the water, just after 11.
But that's miles from Richmond Street. Joe just found the car there, Rosie said.
None of this made any sense.
Rosie?
Joe was yelling now. She yelled back into the phone.
Just hold on. She's not there. She's not on Richmond. She went to the harbor. Oh, God, what the hell is going on here?
Gabe walked to where Rosie was standing and took the phone from her hand. He was close to her now, in his navy suit with his serious face. He and Joe exchanged a few words. They would meet at the car. Joe had the spare key and would drive the car home. Rosie would take his car and follow Gabe to the harbor, where they would look for Laura.
They had suddenly resumed their roles in the story, Gabe making the plan, Joe leading the charge.
What do we do?
Rosie felt helpless as she waited for instructions.
We need those photos. Where's the printer?
Rosie pointed to the stairs.
The attic. Laura's room.
She watched him leave. Suddenly, her throat tightened, choking her. This was real. This was happening. Laura was missing, and the worry had gone from her tangled thoughts to her husband, and now to Gabe.
Laura.
She hadn't looked like a reckless tomboy last night. In that dress and those shoes, her hair down, flowing around her shoulders.
Laura.
But that picture from their past. The sadness, the longing, and those little bloody fists. Gabe came back into the room and stopped in front of her. His arms pulled her in.
It's going to be okay. I promise you, he said.
But when she felt his shirt dampen against her cheek, the tears breaking free, she was no longer that helpless girl. And she was the only one among them who knew that he was wrong.
Chapter 7. Laura. Session number 2. 4 months ago. New York City. Dr. Brody.
Why did you punch your fist through that wall? You were only 6.
Laura, it was probably nothing. My parents used to say I made mountains out of molehills. If someone gave me a rainbow of colors, I would mix them up to make black. Dr. Brody.
Look. Your hand. Your knuckles are turning white.
Laura. Sorry. Sometimes I still smell the plaster, feel the bones bruising. Dr. Brody.
Children develop sharpened skills of perception if they're always in danger. Sometimes they're right about what they see, and sometimes they're wrong. But they see everything.
Laura, I didn't exactly grow up in a jungle. Dr. Brody.
Emotional danger, emotional neglect. Those will do the trick.
Laura, you've lost me. How was I neglected? Dr. Brody.
I don't know. You were the one who was there.
Chapter 8. Laura. The night before. Thursday, 8 p.m. Branston, Connecticut. There is something all wrong about Jonathan Fields' car. Yes, it's a Toyota and not a BMW, but there's something else.
Do you like music?
He asks as we stop at a light. Then he laughs, at himself, I think.
That was stupid. Of course you like music. I meant to ask what kind of music. I can find something on the radio.
That's it. This car has a radio. An actual radio with knobs and buttons. The knob for the volume twists right and left. The one for the channels pushes up or down. Large white arrows lead the way. It has AM and FM. No satellite service. No iPhone connector, Bluetooth, or hardwire. And yet it's not old. It smells new, brand new. Jonathan hits a button to search for a channel. It stops on something with top 40 stuff, and I feel like I'm in fourth grade again, riding with my grandmother.
This okay? He asks.
He glances at me and smiles. The light changes. He makes a right from Schaefer Boulevard onto Grand Street. I hesitate, but then I can't help myself. Grand Street is way out of the way if we're going to the waterfront, and let's just say it's not exactly a scenic route. It's the part of town that's suffered most at every economic downturn. Do you know a secret shortcut? I ask. It's not the best way to ask the question, but it's better than saying, "What the hell are you doing?" which is what I'm thinking and what I want to say. Now he seems unnerved.
No,
he says. He answers with the intonation of a question. So I give him my answer.
It's just, Schaefer goes all the way down, under the train and highway.
I'm pointing back toward the right direction, from which we've just departed.
I go this way to avoid the lights, he says.
He's very clever, only there are lights this way as well, and you have to drive slower because the forgotten teenagers who line the streets at night will walk right out in front of you and not give a shit. This is their neighborhood and they do what they want. We used to come here to buy pot, and from the looks of it, nothing has changed. There's no reason to be here unless you live here or want to score weed. Maybe that's it, I think. Maybe he just smokes a lot of weed and so he makes this turn out of habit. I can live with that. Adele comes on the radio, and I find myself looking again at the dashboard. It's not just the radio. The entire console is old school, analog, red and white, buttons and knobs to twist and push. Not just for the radio, but the heat and the wipers and the odometer reset. It makes my sister's minivan look like a spaceship. The seats are blue speckled fabric, the armrests cheap plastic. No way this guy drives this car by choice. Not Jonathan Fields. We make awkward small talk. It's actually painful, reminding me of the distance we'll have to travel to be more than strangers. And then I'm reminded of how desperately I need to make that journey with someone, anyone. And it all feels hopeless. Maybe it's just Adele. Damn it, Adele. What will it take to make you happy? I hit the search button to silence her.
You said you just moved back here, he says.
Uh-huh.
From the city?
I already told him this on the phone. Uh-huh. I know this is immature. This is the old me talking, and new me tells her to shut the hell up along with Adele and her desperation coming through the radio and make nice conversation. I tell myself I can make that long journey if I just follow the instructions, the rules, one at a time, starting with a normal answer to his question. I was a research analyst, tired of going to the office. I can do what I did at home, and there's a market for independent research now. He pretends to be interested. I follow one industry, chemicals, and the companies in it, but also other industries that impact that one, and the economy and trade policy and currencies. God, I'm boring you, aren't I?
No, not at all. I mean, I do similar work looking at investments, he says. I used to commute into the city, but my firm opened an office here, so it made more sense, you know, when I was married and we thought we'd have a family.
And now you're stuck here? They won't let you transfer back to the city? That's an obvious question, right? This is not easy for me.
I hadn't thought about it. Just trying to get back on my feet, you know?
I nod, look sympathetic. But really, he's been divorced for over a year. No kids. I wonder if he's still in love with his wife, his ex-wife.
Your sister still lives here. It's not so bad, he says.
Rosie could be happy anywhere, I quip. Rosie was happy with Joe because we grew up together, and, well, he's Joe. She was happy to follow him to UConn, happy to come back and be an administrative assistant, aka secretary, and help pay for his law degree. Now, happy to be home with Mason. She's been this way all of our lives. Sometimes I wish I were Rosie. I wish I had her magic potion for being happy. I wish there was a recipe for it. But then again, I would be the one person to measure wrong. Jonathan Fields makes a left, and eventually we go into the bridges for the train and the highway. Now we have to turn left again to get back to Schaefer, where we started. We've just driven in a large rectangle. But I say nothing. He's not driving like he knows his way around, like he's lived downtown for a year. He's driving like he just moved here. We park on the street 4 blocks from the string of bars and restaurants that abut the apartments along the water. It's an inlet from the Long Island Sound, not exactly the ocean, more like a river. But there are boats and sunsets and all of that. The smell of the ocean, the sound of the waves. And it's as far away from the part of town where people like my sister live, so it attracts the young, single crowd. And every divorced dad in the country looking to get laid. Maybe it's a good thing he doesn't know the fastest way here. Maybe if he did, I would worry more. Jonathan Fields wears dark tailored jeans and a loose button-down shirt, tucked in with a belt, loafers, dress socks. 2 buttons are undone at the top of the shirt, just enough to reveal a small tuft of chest hair. No jewelry. Thank God. I'm a fan of chest hair. It's masculine, manly. I don't understand all the waxing and laser removal. I like manly men. It makes me feel that it's safe to lay down my sword and shield, that I won't get ambushed in the night because someone else is watching the perimeter. It's nice to be part of an army, even if it's a small one. Asshole had chest hair. I used to weave my fingers through it. And suddenly I miss him more than I can bear. I think his name, his real name, and feel his embrace. I feel his skin against my skin, arms and legs weaving, torsos locked together. Warm breath on my neck as his mouth finds its way to mine. A deep kiss. A sigh. He said the words as we lay still. I love you. And I believed him. For once, I let myself believe. I got it wrong. It won't happen again. And now, I have to start over. Make another long journey from strangers to lovers. I'm so tired, and we haven't even begun, Jonathan Fields. He pulls the key out of the ignition and looks at me with a smile. He says something corny like, "Shall we?" And my brain feels like a circuit's been tripped by the conflicting information. The car, the shall we, but then the jeans and the chest hair. I feel confused, so I smile and open the car door. I need air. Where should we go? I ask. I haven't actually eaten here before. I come here with Rosie and Mason to watch the boats. There's a huge playground, and it's a long drive from her house. All the makings of an outing. And Rosie loves her outings. I feel a surge of warmth wash over me as I think about Rosie and Mason and Joe and my work and the future. There is so much that is good. I hear Mason call my name. Lala! I hear Rosie in my head. You don't need a man. And I think, as I watch Jonathan Fields walk, that I want one.
I know a place, Jonathan says.
He waits for me to walk ahead of him, and I feel his hand on the small of my back as he gently guides me into a bar, sending that shiver. But this one is prickly and uncomfortable, replacing the warmth. It's not the way someone touches someone before they've had a decent conversation, or a drink at least. Or maybe they do, and this is just me not knowing what the fuck I'm doing. There's a table in the back corner, and I sit facing the wall because he takes the other seat, facing the crowd. I've been told that's what a gentleman does, something about keeping watch, watching our backs. But really, let's be honest. We're at a bar with a whole mess of attractive young people. I can think of other reasons he might want to sit facing the crowd. Maybe he wants to keep a lookout for women who might recognize him and call his name and chase after us as we scurry to the door. He leaves to get us drinks, and I need one the way a fish needs water. I used to think that I think too much, that I search for answers where there are no questions, find solutions that have no problems, that I make mountains out of molehills, as my dear mother used to say. My mother and Dick, they both used to say it. And then I stopped thinking too much, and guess what happened? I slammed right into the side of a mountain. Seriously, just give me a magic pill to make it all go away. Or a cocktail, which is exactly what appears before me. Thanks, I say to Jonathan Fields as he sits down. I glance up inconspicuously as I swallow a large portion of my drink, just waiting for his eyes to find someone younger or hotter or sexier. But he doesn't. He looks at me, and only at me. And suddenly I want to be the woman I think he wants. New me.
Okay,
he says, leaning back in his chair. He's comfortable now, not like he was in the car, or even at the first bar. It's like he's just come home from a long day at the office and kicked off his shoes.
Let's start over. I'm so bad with first dates. I never know what to talk about. What to ask about. It's like walking in a field of landmines.
And just like that, bullseye, I kick off my shoes as well. I know, I say to him with as much relief as I can possibly display in one facial expression. It's so horrible, right? He shakes his head with enthusiasm and leans forward.
You know, it's like the worst of everything, meeting online. If you go out with someone you know from work or someplace, there's a starting point, a familiarity. And if you meet someone in a bar, then it's just like flirting and all that. There's a rule book for it, or a handbook. You know what I mean, right?
Yes, I say. This is my first time doing this, and it's awful. I mean, not you. That didn't come out right. You're not awful. It's just hard to find a place to start. It's just like you said, Jonathan Fields. Only not exactly, because I have never known any of this to be easy. Not ever. Not even with asshole. I kept the last text message he sent me, the one saying it was over and to never contact him again. I read it sometimes to remind myself about the mountains.
Okay,
he says again. He likes that word a lot.
So just ask me anything. What do you want to know?
Honestly? I ask.
Yes, anything.
He leans back again. He reaches for his beer, and this time his eyes do a quick scan of the room. It's perfectly normal, I remind myself. He's facing out. He's protecting me from wild animals that could pounce at any moment. His eyes do not stop and linger on anyone, but returned to me in my question. Okay, I begin, because if Jonathan likes that word, new me likes it too. People are always more comfortable when you acclimate to them, to their style and their language. It's why people often look like their dogs. I learned this in a psychology class. What I really want to know about is your divorce. How you met your wife, why you got married, what went wrong. Is that too personal? It's fine if it is, but that is honestly what I most want to know. This is a lie, of course. What I most want to know is what happened to his BMW, or why he told me he had one when he doesn't. And even if he did lie to impress me and lure me out, there's just no way he chose that car without a gun to his head. And that woman from the first bar calling out his name, and the way we got here, to the harbor.
Okay.
He begins his answer with his favorite word.
We met in college, Swarthmore, senior year. But it's not what you think. We didn't just stay together and then get married. We actually broke up after graduation. I moved to Boston. That's where I'm from. Sad to say, I lived with my parents for about a year while I was looking for a job. She came here, or to New York, rather. Then a few years later, when we were about 28, we reconnected on Facebook.
He says this like it's a miracle, so I light up my whole face.
No way, I say. It's a miracle.
Yup. And we started talking, and then I came to see her, and she came up to see me. And then we lived in Boston for a while, and then back here. We really thought we would start a family.
Now he seems sad, so I become a gray sky. I'm sorry, I say. Can I ask what happened? He goes on for a solid 10 minutes, talking about all of their fertility treatments and how his wife has endometriosis, etc., and TMI. I remind myself that we are trying to travel a long distance at the speed of light. I am sympathetic. I am. I truly am. But I want to know about that car and why he didn't move back to New York. It's not fair to Jonathan Fields that I feel annoyed. He's just answering the question I asked. He finally stops. He gets us another round. I watch him walk away and think that I like the way he walks and that he is a nice man. He loved his wife. He wanted to have children. He has parents who love him enough to let him live in their basement after college. He is a good man, and I will try to find a way to let him in. Then I think this. I think about my sister, and how if I met her today, I would not make her a friend. I wouldn't dislike her, but we are too different, and we would annoy each other. She would judge me, and I would judge her, and we would get in a girl fight, and that would be that. But she is family, blood, and so I will not leave her, not in a million years. The things about her that might annoy me, I find endearing. I don't know if she feels this way about me, but I think she does. Even if I move away again, part of me will always be hers, and part of her will always be mine. She is the first person I call when the shit really hits the fan, just like it did not 2 months ago. And she came running as fast as lightning. So what is it about love between strangers? What makes two people who are not family, not blood, stay and not leave? Do they just decide to do it? Do they swallow down their misery at being together when they want to be apart? Staying with Rosie is not a choice. Loving Rosie is not a choice. Then I think about Jonathan Fields and his wife and all those years they spent together. And then she just decided to leave, just like that? Or maybe not. Maybe I don't know the whole story. Still, I wonder.
Okay, he says. Now my turn.
He sets down the new drinks. I smile sheepishly. Okay, shoot.
Was that guy in New York, the one you mentioned on the phone, was that a serious thing? Was it a hard breakup?
I try to decide what he's asking me, really. Is it whether I'm capable of a long-term relationship? Is it whether I'm still in love with someone else? Or is he trying to find out why I came back home? And from there, why I left? Yes and no, I begin. It wasn't that long that we dated. But I did have feelings for him, and yes, it was hard when he ended things. I guess we're in a similar type of boat. Obviously, mine is much smaller. He studies me carefully.
You said on the phone that he sent you one text ending things and then just disappeared, stopped calling and texting you. Did you try to find out why?
I shake my head. No. I mean, if someone dumps you in a text and then disappears like that, I think that's a sign. What would prevent him from doing that again? Walking away is a bad habit, but it is a habit and it's hard to break. I expect him to pontificate on this rather introspective observation, but instead he dwells on my behavior.
But you didn't at least reach out? Even on social media? Ask one of his friends?
Now I feel cornered. I can't answer this without revealing the fact that I don't use social media, and that I didn't really know his friends. We spent our time together alone. It was new. New and perfect. I shrug, and that's all I give him.
Okay, you know what? He says. It doesn't matter. We've both moved on in our boats, and now here we are, and that's a good thing. I know that sounds trite, but I really believe that. Everything that matters is here right now, or coming tomorrow. And what I see here right now is an incredibly beautiful, smart woman. And I am lucky that guy was a total prick, because now you're here and not there.
He says this with total sincerity. Not even my finely tuned skills of perception can detect an iota of BS. It comes again, the surge of warmth like I felt before. He's found a wormhole. We talk more about this, about life and about mistakes, and how hard it is to look forward or live in the present moment. He speaks also of his family in Boston, his mother who just died a year ago, his father who was married to her for 44 years. He speaks of a sister and her family who moved to Colorado, and I speak of my sister, Joe and Mason. He doesn't ask me if I want children, so I don't have to lie, and the conversation keeps flowing like the water just outside, flowing into an ocean. Of what, I have no idea, but I like it. I like it all. His eyes stay on me the whole time. I can smell his skin when he leans forward to sip his beer, and then I smell the beer when he leans back. And all of it mixes together with the vodka I've been drinking into a brilliant cocktail of attraction. I fight to keep it. I fight against the little things that enter my brain and go on the list of concerns I will use to build the mountain of a molehill. Things I am perceiving that don't add up. The timeline of his story between college and moving back here. His company, which doesn't sound like any of the companies that have stayed out here in Connecticut. He says it was a hedge fund, but the larger ones have moved out of Branston. I know this because his business is my business. There are more wrong things that I've been gathering, facial expressions, sideways questions about my past, my childhood. I can't decide if these things are normal because I'm not normal. My sense of perception, my mountains for molehills, my fists for hands. I drove my parents crazy. I know I did. They told me I did. I was hard to love, maybe impossible. Maybe I still am. I shove this all aside. Jonathan Fields is a nice man. And he leans forward for his beer, but really he wants to be closer to me. I can feel it. These thoughts are wrong. These concerns are meaningless. I gather them so I can push away nice men like Jonathan Fields who want to love me. And I do this so I can keep finding the wrong men who won't love me. I want to cry. I feel tears coming, but I hold them back. Knowledge is power, right? I will stop this from happening. This is why I came home. This is my job now, to stop old me from ruining my life. I go to the bathroom. I splash cold water on my face. I get my shit together and return to the table. Jonathan Fields gives me a huge smile. Then he opens his mouth to start a new conversation. Only it's not new. It's the same one he's been trying to have all night.
Okay, he says. So why is it you haven't been back home sooner?
What is going on here? Why is he so interested in my past? He seems to know about my list of concerns. Maybe he's trying to stop me from making it any longer. But that's exactly what he's doing.
You know what? He says. Let's get out of here. Go for a walk by the river.
I tell myself it's nothing. A molehill, not a mountain. There are no instincts I can trust. No skills I can rely upon. Just determination. My mouth opens, and out comes the word he likes so much. Okay.